Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we're talking with Neighborhood Story Project founder Abram Himmelstein, who's getting ready for the big write-a-thon coming up June 10th. And we'll hear Fred Kasten's Sound of Books interview with Philip Palmedo, who's written a new biography of New Orleans sculptor Lynn Emery. And we'll have some recommendations for beach reading. Abram Himmelstein is a writer in his own right. He's the author of Tales of a Punk Rock Nothing, an underground classic, as well as What the Hell Am I Doing Here? The 100 T-Shirt Project. Today, we'll be talking with him about another effort that looms large in his life, the Neighborhood Story Project, now 8 years old. Abram and Rachel Brunlin, who both teach at the University of New Orleans, founded the Neighborhood Story Project 8 years ago. Coming up June 10th, they'll be holding the fourth annual Neighborhood Story Project Write-A-Thon. Abram, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, the Neighborhood Story Project has published 12 books now, and some of them are New Orleans favorites. I particularly love Coming Out the Door for the Ninth Ward, about the Nine Times Social and Pleasure Club, and The House of Dance and Feathers, about Ronald Lewis's Ninth Ward Backyard Museum. Now, this began with a challenge to your students as you were teaching in McDonough High School.
That's right. Rachel was teaching school across the hall, and she had found this way to really activate students' imaginations by asking them to write for publication. And she was producing these zines, and I was like, this needs to happen on a larger scale. And so she and I got together, and we thought about what a real writing program at McDonough would look like. And we came up with the idea of asking students to write about something that every New Orleanian, I think, fundamentally cares about, which is their own neighborhoods. And so we asked our students, we went around the school and we said, anybody interested in writing a book? It'll be the last period of the day and you'll come to our office, which was across the street. Come over and work on this book every day and you'll get $1,000 royalties when the book comes out. And we kind of anticipated it would be something like a yearbook for a block. We didn't anticipate the kind of heart and soul that the students would put into it. And we didn't really understand the way in which a neighborhood would coalesce around the books. But you know, neighborhoods is a real New Orleans strength, and the neighborhoods really came together around the books that these students were writing. We published the books in June of 2005 and right before Katrina, and they were the best sellers after Harry Potter for the 2 months before the storm hit.
Isn't that amazing?
It was incredible. I mean, we were not prepared for the level at which they would be loved and embraced by the whole neighborhood. And it was heartening to hear, you know, people would sign their books. It would go around and say, you know, this is my book. Would you sign it? And in that sense, it did. It felt like a yearbook in that everyone felt like invested in it and as though they owned the book.
Describe some of those early books for us.
You know, each student kind of had this moment where they had a breakthrough about each of those books. And so I remember Ashley Nelson came to us and she said, you know, you've told me to write about my block, but that's a crazy idea because I really need to write about my whole project about the Lafitte. And so when we couldn't really say no, and so when she said, I'm doing that, the writing began to take off and flourish, and she really kind of owned it from that point on. And each student had a kind of breakthrough moment like that. Waukesha Jackson, when she finally got ready to write kind of honestly about what she and her mom had been through together, her book began to really soar, and you could feel that moment of narrative honesty that I feel like is present within every writer, but we often write away from at the beginning because our truths can be quite terrifying. And so a lot of what happens in the process of writing a book for any writer, I think, is that you come to a place that has power because it has so much meaning. And when you come to that place, it's terrifying. But when the students cross that, they begin to write, I think, with a real power and urgency to get their story told and just get their story told in a way that feels honest to them. So.
And how did you advocate for them? How did the process work exactly with them?
There was a moment in every writing process where the students either began to become so invested that they couldn't stop writing, or we pushed them to a place where they get very invested. And so that comes with the kind of relationships that are built over time. And when students bring you a story that they honestly have felt very emotional while writing, when that story is treated with dignity and when people respond, both the teachers and their fellow students respond to that story with empathy, I think that that draws yet more stories out of each student, because there's something about the process of being heard, I think, that all humans crave. Humans are meaning machines. And so when students have the chance to make meaning through writing, I think that there's something, I don't want to say biological yearning, but nearly a biological yearning for students and humans to make meaning through telling stories.
Mm-hmm. So you were poised at this bright, bright moment before Katrina. And how did the books change after that? I think of those post-Katrina books as really remarkable documents.
Well, when the storm hit, we had just finished that first round and we're just beginning the process of starting a second round of books at John McDonough, whereas the first year we had had to nearly beg students to participate. We had had 45 applications for the second year, and it had a real head of steam behind it. And so when the storm hit, you know, John McDonough didn't open that first year. And so we were casting about trying to figure out what it meant to be a community documentary project. In that moment, when Nine Times, who Rachel had been working with, came to us and wanted to write a book that was for the public and not necessarily for an anthropological audience. Over the course of a year, that book came together with Rachel and I and the guys from Nine Times really living and breathing that book. And so it felt like a bit of our response to the storm, because that book, in a lot of ways, was just tied to the renewal of a tradition.
And the whole, I love that book. I really did love that book. And it's the first real book about a social aid and pleasure club, right?
It's definitely the first one written by the club themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's really our methodology, is collaborative ethnography. And so we have taken a lot of pride and a lot of joy in doing that kind of work of having people document their own stories and continue to own those stories after they come out.
So, I love your motto too.
Our stories told by us. That's right.
So how did the write-a-thon get started? Who came up with that?
Well, we were looking for the right kind of fundraiser. We, for the 4 years after Katrina, we didn't, you know, everybody we felt like was contributing in 1,000 different ways to the rebuilding of the city. And we were lucky enough to have enough money to be solvent, you know, for those years. And so we had partnered with the New York Writers Coalition, and they had a write-a-thon, which was very different in nature, but it went by the same title, that they had a write-a-thon. And so what could be more organic than having people over for barbecue and asking them to raise money on our behalf? And so really the way this works is that everybody asks their own network for just a little bit of money, and that multiplied by all the people who do this equals a very successful fundraiser. And so what happens is it's going to be June 10th, and everyone listening is very invited. You can go to the Neighborhood Story Project website to check out how to get involved. But all that happens is at 1 p.m. we all gather. Everyone talks about the kind of writing they're going to be doing. We have professionals and amateurs. We have the most professionals and the most amateurs all gathered together. We turn our office into kind of the quiet zone, and people take advantage of that. Some people are working on dissertations. Some people are writing fiction. Some people are catching up on correspondence, but they're writing, and it's quiet and it's library-esque, and all you hear is the sound of, you know, pen scratching on paper and fingers typing on keyboards, and that's it. And then kitty corner from our office is this really great barbershop, Cut Creators. And Cut Creators is nice enough every year to open up their barbershop to us. And so that's kind of the more raucous end of the write-a-thon. And there's barbecue from the joint. There's cake from Cake Cafe. And people are hanging out there and just socializing and or writing if some people need noise to write. And so we have library end and we have the barbershop end. And that's what the write-a-thon looks like. And so we write from 1 to 5.
And who are some of the writers who will be there? Can you name some names?
Some of the writers who will be there. Well, I'm so deeply excited about really all of them. I hate to select any, but the former Nine Times are the guys who wrote the Coming Out the Door for the Ninth Ward. They're participating as a group. We have Benny Pete from the Hot Eight, who's writing a book now with the Neighborhood Story Project. He's going to be there writing, and he's going to be raising money. Bruce Barnes, who is
Bruce Sun Pie Barnes,
one of my favorite New Orleanians. The Neighborhood Story Project is actually doing a book with his program at the National New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park. Has a program called Music for All Ages, And so Bruce is going to be participating as a writer. And actually the Next Neighbors Story Project book to come out is going to be a collaboration between Bruce and Rachel and the participants in Music for All Ages.
Oh, that's
which
great.
Is, do you know about that program? Mm-hmm. It's just phenomenal. So the younger musicians are interviewing the older musicians. And so that's going to come out in the fall. And we are really, I've seen, Rachel's mock-ups of the pages. They're quite, quite great.
And what will you be writing during the write-a-thon?
Well, I'm trying to frame out the new book that I'm working on, which is a book on the backside of the fairgrounds, which has been coming together over the last 3 years. And it is, I'm really, really excited about it. We've been working with 17 different writers on essentially documenting life on the backside of the horse racing end of the fairgrounds. I know many people here know it as the home to Jazz Fest, but for 5 months of the year, it's some of the finest racing in this hemisphere. And a lot of the stories that are told about essentially horse owners and jockeys and trainers. And those people are in this book, but the other people who are often overlooked are the guys who muck out the stables and the exercise riders and the guys who run in the cafeteria in the backside there and the chaplain. Just all of those people, their stories are often really not known. I mean, there's a whole city that lives on the backside. And so that's going to be the book that comes after Music for All Ages.
Can't wait. Mm. You love that Damon Runyon-esque
yes.
life of the track.
I do.
Oh, we've been talking with Abram Himmelstein about the Neighborhood Story Project's fourth annual write-a-thon, which is Sunday, June 10th from 1 to 5 at the Neighborhood Story Project, 2202 La Perouse Street. Check it out at neighborhoodstoryproject.org. Thanks so much, Abram.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's time now for The Sound of Books with Fred Kasten. Today, art writer Philip Palmedo's lavishly illustrated new biography of New Orleans sculptor Lynn Emery, titled simply, Lynn Emery.
Philip Palmedo grew up in New York City.
I was very lucky in that my parents would take me to the Metropolitan Museum in New York and so forth. But it was really in college when I studied art history at Williams College that I got a deep interest in art.
Especially sculpture.
People sometimes ask me why I got so interested in sculpture as opposed to painting. I like painting a lot. But somehow, from the very beginning, I felt an attraction to sculpture, to the tangible quality, and the kind of independence of sculpture as an artistic object.
Philip Palmedo earned a PhD in physics from MIT, then enjoyed a very successful career in physics and later business. Palmedo's work occasionally required him to write, which he found he liked. And about a decade ago, he started writing books about sculpture and sculptors. 3 years ago, in a fine piece of serendipity, Palmedo and his wife just happened to take the same Rhine River cruise as Lynn Emery, whose work he had known for some time and admired. Palmedo sought out Emery, and before long, they were talking about the possibility of a book.
It's a delicate matter, frankly, because it's a significant commitment on both of our parts, and we're both it's a risk we're both taking, right? Because this would be the first book that she has had written about her. And she's putting her work, in a way, in my hands. And I'm committing to a year of my life to try to understand and present, communicate what her work is all about. But she knew a couple of the people who I'd written about before. she checked me out, I checked her out. And fortunately, we all agreed it would be a good thing to do.
And Palmetto quickly discovered that Lynn Emery's personal history is as compelling as her art.
She was working as a reporter in Paris, freelance reporter, and was asked to do an article on sculpture, which she knew nothing about. But she noticed that across the street from her hotel, there was a sculptor's studio, so she wandered in there, hoping to just get some information about what sculpture was about. And it turned out to be the studio of Ossip Zadkine, who was at that time probably one of the most prominent cubistic sculptors in the world. And she liked what she saw and signed up for his class. He taught his students in a realistic mode, and particularly in a simplified style. He thought very highly of Egyptian sculpture. Simplification of style is something that I think has carried through Lynn's work. Maybe it was because of Zadkine, maybe it was because she had an inclination from the very beginning for that mode.
That 1 year with Zadkine in Paris in the late 40s would be the only formal instruction in sculpting Lynn Emery ever had.
She was really independent from the age of 15. And one of the things I try to do in this book and others is to relate the personality to the artistic evolution of an artist and to the artist's work. I think independence is one of the things that has characterized Lynn's work.
And publisher Hudson Hills has done a superb job of illustrating Emery's work in Lynn Emery.
It's a beautifully produced book. You know, it's really satisfying for a writer. I don't have much control once I turn in a manuscript to the publisher. I kibitz, I say, you know, this should be here, this should be there. But it's really a delight when a book comes out of this quality, reflecting the care of very good editors and publishers.
Writer Philip Palmetto, author of the widely acclaimed, highly recommended new volume, Lynn Emery. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
It's June already, and that means it's time to think about summer reading. Here are some new books to think about tucking into that beach bag. In One Person by John Irving. I still have a t-shirt for The World According to Garp, so I'm a John Irving fan from way back. I had high hopes for In One Person, the story of William Abbott, who, like many of his predecessors in Irving's work, is what Irving calls a sexual suspect. Growing up in a small New England town in an academic setting, Billy inhabits familiar Irving territory as well. And when he falls in love for the first time, we know we're in for a rocky ride because Billy's first real love is Miss Helen Frost, the much older town librarian who guides him to the novels of James Baldwin, Charles Dickens, Thomas Hardy, the Brontes, as well as to so much other knowledge. And while it takes Billy a while to realize that Helen Frost is really a transsexual, it just doesn't make any difference. The heart wants, as Woody Allen says, what the heart wants. So we're off, as Billy's family copes with all this, even his amazing cross-dressing Grandpa Harry, all part of a troop of thespians who love nothing more than putting on a show. There's really a lot of cross-dressing in Shakespeare when you think about it. With all that theatrical reading background, it's no wonder Billy becomes a writer. So many stories, so many desires, and on he goes through life, falling in love with men and women, hoping he will survive the plague of AIDS before finally finding his true calling in life. It's a timely novel, a political one to be sure, and maybe not John Irving's best, but still a good way to while away summer afternoons. Another is Calling Invisible Women by Jean Ray. I've loved Jean Ray's work ever since her tale of midlife romance Julie and Romeo, and this one strikes a chord with me for obvious reasons. When Clover Hobart wakes up one morning to find that she's invisible, it's a shock to say the least. But her invisibility fades, then returns, finally for good. Every middle-aged woman knows this sensation, but few of us, I dare to say, have imagined its freedoms. Before long, Clover has experienced the thrill of meeting other invisible women, walking around the world naked, although there are certain hygienic concerns, flying free, eavesdropping on her kids on the school bus, and her overworked doctor husband in his office. It turns out that the cause of this invisibility is pharmaceutical, a combination of an often prescribed hormone, a calcium supplement, and an antidepressant, combined with what else? Botox. And who else to better fight a big pharmaceutical company than a band of invisible women? The opportunities for changing the world are endless. This is a smart, funny book for everyone who's ever wondered if the world really sees them for who they are. And isn't that all of us, really? And coming up on the market, amid the revival of interest in a movie version of A Confederacy of Dunces, a handwritten letter from John Kennedy Toole is coming up at a Sotheby's auction June 15th. The lot, which is estimated to sell at Sotheby's for between $10,000 and $15,000, includes the letter, which is from Toole to his friends Patricia Milton and Gordon Rickles, old friends from Lafayette, a first edition of the novel Confederacy of Dunces, as well as a copy of the New Orleans Review containing the first published excerpt from Confederacy, and 10 children's books that belong to Toole. Check out Sotheby's.com for more information. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Michael Barker discusses and signs The Watery Part of the World, Thursday, June 7th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet Deborah Morgan is the featured reader at 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. August Palumbo signs The Assassin Hunter, a true crime story, Saturday, June 9th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Jim Miller signs Where the Water Kept Rising, a college athletic director's fight to save a New Orleans sports institution, Saturday, June 9th at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank, and again Tuesday, June 12th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Today's guest, Abram Himmelstein, presides over the Write-A-Thon for the Neighborhood Story Project, Sunday, June 10th from 1 to 5 at 2202 La Perouse Street. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, June 10th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. And novelist Richard Ford, whose new book is Canada, will be the guest of honor at the Faulkner Society's fundraiser, Juleps in June, Sunday evening, June 10th at 6:30. For details and ticket information, check out wordsandmusic.org. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org or email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.